This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think what he has done is he has definitely dismissed them because some of them were downright incompetent. Others had were labeled as corrupt. Some of them, he might reappoint some of them, but into different dockets. But this gives him a chance to bring in fresh blood people.
That's Edgar Getua, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, on President William Ruto dismissing all but two of his cabinet members today. Details coming up. Also, violence has forced Doctors Without Borders to evacuate from one of the few remaining hospitals in Sudan's capital. And the commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army has been forging ever closer ties with Russia. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Kenyan President William Ruto fired almost his entire cabinet today after weeks of anti-government protests. Only Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua and Prime Cabinet Secretary Musalia Mudavadi have been left in their posts. Ruto said the decision was made upon reflection and a holistic appraisal of his cabinet. For further analysis on the cabinet dismissals and the overall state of Kenya after the youth uprising, I talked with Edgar Getua, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi.
The current state of politics in Kenya is a citizenry, and especially the youth, who have decided they are going to speak up about what ails them, what is disturbing them, and they are going to hold government accountable. And that's why they launched their protests around 3 weeks ago, 3 to 4 weeks ago. And we can see with that pressure, the president has changed his tact. He has agreed to listen to them. He's been trying to engage them. And it has led to their demands for him to dismiss the cabinet. And that has happened.
So he said he is acutely aware that the people of Kenya, like you just said, have very high expectations of him. And they believe that his administration can undertake the most extensive transformation. Is this the dismissal of the ministers one of the first steps he's taking?
I think, yes. I think what he has done, is he has definitely dismissed them because some of them were downright incompetent. Others had were labeled as corrupt. Some of them, he might reappoint some of them, but into different dockets. But this gives him a chance to bring in fresh blood, people who are untainted, and people who are willing to work, and people who are going to carry his vision, bear his vision, and carry his vision. But some of them had become very complacent, very arrogant in terms of just their conduct and what and how they were doing things.
You are so right, Doctor. The anger over the bloated bureaucracy and luxurious lives of senior officials, you know, helped fuel the protests.
Yeah, you're right, by the way. I mean, when you get stories of cabinet ministers being caught abroad with, you know, $2 million, you know, in hard cash, wearing flashy clothes, driving and buying the latest big cars. And let me tell you, and the cost of living in Kenya had gotten unbearable, the taxes, people cannot make ends meet. Yes, the frustration, the collective anger is what we are now seeing exhibited in the young people. But what they are speaking is actually the voice of nearly all the Kenyans out there who are saying, enough is enough. We need to seek change. We need to get a government in place that cares for the people, that is functioning and doing things for the people. That is what you're seeing. So Kenya is going through a renaissance, a revolution, a rebirth, and that is what Kenyans want to see with their government.
The bottom line is Kenya's debt. So how will Ruto's administration find the money to pay off the debt without angering millions of Kenyans barely getting by and without slowing down the economy?
I think now, thank you for the question. I think there is going to be a very delicate balancing act between development and debt repayment. From the taxes that Kenyans have given him, I think what Kenyans want to see is value for their money. Value for their money means we can see development, even if it is not a lot, But number one, reduce the size of the civil service, reduce the size of the cabinet, reduce the size of government expenditure, buying big vehicles, fuel guzzlers. All those things collectively can save some bit of money that can go towards debt repayment, start restructuring some of those debts, because I believe the two can be done. If you remember when President Kibaki came into power in the year 2002, President Kibaki found the economy that was almost dead from the Moi regime. President Kibaki started collecting taxes, ensuring that the little money we collect is utilized well, and Kenya's economy started growing. Investor confidence in the country started picking up, and the economy started growing. So it is not rocket science. It can be done. I think what the president needs is just a new team of economic advisors who are going to show him how to balance between debt repayment and development of the country while reducing the wage bill. And I think we will get to a comfortable state, because adding taxes, I can assure you, he is not going to attempt to touch to add taxes in the near 1 or 2 years, because he has now seen what can happen and what kind of anger can be displayed.
That was Dr. Edgar Gitua, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, speaking with me by phone from Nairobi. Violence in Khartoum has forced Doctors Without Borders, MSF, to evacuate its team from the Turkish hospital, one of the few remaining hospitals operating in the Sudanese capital. The MSF team has been providing hands-on, life-saving treatment in the hospital for nearly 14 months during the ongoing war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF. Claire Nicolette, head of MSF's emergency response in Sudan, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the decision was not made lightly.
Unfortunately, the past months, the months of June, it was very hard for the team, with many intrusion inside the hospital and some violence with some armed men coming and shooting around for treating their patient quicker and so on. And really, the situation was so hard for the team that they requested to go out of the Turkish hospital for a little while at least. So the situation was really, really tense and very difficult to continue activities in Khartoum at the moment.
And I understand that even at one point recently at the Turkish hospital, the team was aggressively woken up and Kalashnikovs were fired in their bedrooms.
Yes, indeed. So the team has been living in the hospital for months now, most of the team at least. Unfortunately, yes, in June, there was some wounded because of the current fighting, obviously. And yes, armed men penetrated inside the house and the rooms of our staff and start shooting around. So fortunately, no one was wounded, but it was really, really very aggressive and complicated for the team.
Is surgery even still going on at this hospital?
So unfortunately, with the current situation, our team being outside of the hospital now, Ministry of Health is trying its best to continue activities, but surgery has to stop because of the lack of now and of MSF withdrawal for the moment.
Who controls this part of Khartoum? Why do you feel like, is there a blockade underway? And is that why you feel like you've had to pull out your team?
So unfortunately, we cannot rotate our team since October last year. So because of the blockade indeed, both for personnel and also for supplies. So it means that Sudanese authorities have refused one after the other our request of travel permit to get to Khartoum, to this area under RSF control, which means that indeed we cannot rotate our team. We didn't manage to send enough supply for almost 8 to 9 months. So the situation has been really, really difficult, and with a lack of staff and with lack of protection as well of presence of our full team as much as we could.
Now that MSF has pulled out of Turkish hospital, at least for now, how many hospitals or health facilities are even operating still in the capital?
So there are very few hospitals working, I mean, functional at the moment. There are still a few of them, but for instance, for pediatrics, for maternity, it's really difficult now. And there are, for instance, neonatology, it's only in Turkish hospitals. So now I'm very unsure our Ministry of Health will manage to continue activity there and we will be able to treat these patients. So for surgery, there are 2 to 3 hospitals still operating, and obviously as well, because it's so difficult for the people to move around in the city, even to get there, it will not be easy to access the few operational hospitals.
So what is MSF asking for from both sides in this war?
Well, basically, we really call for warring parties to protect civilians, to protect health structures, to protect health staff. And unfortunately, that's not what we are witnessing for more than a year since the war started. And also to facilitate our activities by giving us travel permits, visas, which is also not granted for long times.
That was Claire Nicolette, head of MSF's emergency response in Sudan. She was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam in Paris. General Haftar, commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, has been forging ever closer ties to Russia. In recent months, Moscow has been allowed to unload thousands of tons of military equipment at Libya's Tobruk port as it seeks to supply Russian operations across Africa. Russia has been trying to create a naval base for its fleet in Tobruk, and the U.S. State Department says Moscow has also started forming the African Legion in Libya, which is supposed to replace mercenaries from the Wagner group who will use these forces not only in Libya, but also in Burkina Faso, Mali, the Central African Republic, and Niger. Wolfgang Porstey, senior advisor to the Austrian Center for Security, discussed the developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
This is a very serious threat, not only to Western interests, but especially to the stability of Africa. Russia combines a ruthless military campaign with a predator towards African resources. And as the experience with Wagner mercenaries in Mali clearly shows, there might be an initial military success, but already in the midterm, the situation in the countries targeted by the Russians deteriorates. Northern Mali is now almost entirely under the control of various opposition groups, including jihadis and Tuareg. So while the Russians might help some elites to stay in power and to enrich themselves, the suffering of the broader population will increase. The Islamist insurgencies in the region will certainly benefit from this. And coming to Libya, Libya plays as a logistic hub a crucial role in the Russian strategy. But unfortunately, Russia is playing this game very cleverly by maintaining good relations in Libya, not only with Khalifa Haftar in the east, but also with the Dabeba government in the west. So even if there are presidential elections, and even if Dabeba becomes president or Saif al-Islam, I don't expect any change in this.
So what's the latest Russian strategy in Africa, especially in the belt of military coups in the Sahel region?
Russia's Africa strategy must be seen in context with the global strategy. For Russia, they are currently in a struggle with the West. The resources in Africa play in this struggle an important role. This is why Russia wants to get a grip on these resources in Africa and deny them to the West. The best tool to reach this is to cooperate with the various military coup leaders, because these people are obviously not the favored partners of the West. And as we have seen from Mali to Niger, as soon as if there is a military coup, and as soon as the West is stopping the relations and the cooperation with these regimes, Russia steps in by offering military help, by offering them military equipment, by offering the military coup leaders, obviously, to stay in power. And this is something which is certainly a threat for the whole region. I don't expect that these military coup leaders are able, even with Russian help, to stabilize this region. But this will certainly work in a sense of the Russians that the West will have much more difficult to gain access to the resources of this region in Africa.
So what does that mean for the stability of Africa? following the withdrawal of the French troops and then evacuation of the U.S. base in Niger.
For the time being, the West had a military, political, economic strategy towards Africa. This means they were relying not only on diplomacy, not only relying on economic aid and on development programs, but also on military support. This pillar of the strategy has now broken away. This means that insurgency groups in the region, this means that the terrorist groups in the region will have it much easier to survive, will have it much easier to attack the governments, because the Russians won't be able to bring in the same sophisticated weapon systems, the same sophisticated, especially surveillance systems, as especially the Americans, but also the French did. So altogether, the withdrawal of the Americans and of the French from the Southern Sahara region are no good for the stability of Northern Africa altogether.
That was Wolfgang Poschtei, senior advisor at the Austrian Center for Security, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Junta-led Burkina Faso has adopted a plan to ban homosexuality, becoming the latest African nation to do so despite international condemnation. A statement by the presidency says a cabinet meeting today approved the plan. The French news agency AFP says Justice Minister Edasso Rodrigue Bayala has not spelled out what the punishments would be. The bill will become law once approved by deputies in a transitional parliament in place since two 2022 coups in the West African nation. In August, the country's media watchdog decided to ban television channels promoting homosexuality. Same-sex relations were not banned in Burkina Faso before the military takeovers. It is illegal in around 30 African countries, and some like Ghana and Uganda have recently toughened anti-gay laws. If former U.S. President Donald Trump wins the November election in his rematch with current President Joe Biden, he may seek to replace the entire federal bureaucracy under direct presidential control. That move is outlined in a playbook crafted by more than 100 conservative organizations on a prospective second Trump administration. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman at the White House.
Donald Trump, campaigning for president 8 years ago, promised to bend Washington's bureaucracy to his will.
If I'm elected president, we are going to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C.
Trump's continuing vow to drain the swamp, meaning to rid government of those who impose policy but are unaccountable to the president, is now backed with a blueprint crafted by more than 100 conservative groups. Project 2025, published by the right-wing Heritage Foundation, instructs how to swing a wrecking ball against the administrative state. Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts is warning there may be violence along the journey to its implementation.
We are in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be.
After that incendiary comment, Trump tried to distance himself from Project 2025, asserting that while he knows nothing about it and its authors, I disagree with some of the things they're saying. The project's head, Paul Danz, appearing on C-SPAN, left no doubt Trump's words and ideas were the inspiration.
He was president for 4 years, so many of the ideas are carry-ons from his original work. So I would like to think that a lot of it does kind of spring from that first term of Trump.
VOA requested an interview with the Heritage Foundation. The think tank said it could not make anyone available, but emailed a statement stressing Project 2025 does not speak for any candidate or campaign. Project 2025 seeks to eliminate the checks and balances writers of the Constitution, such as James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, crafted through dividing power among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the government, according to Will Marshall, the president of the Progressive Policy Institute.
Madison and Jefferson ought to be spinning in their graves when they see how much power they want to concentrate in the next president's hands. And if that president happens to be Donald Trump, then it's a kind of a nightmare for the country, given the way he's misused power in the past.
President Joe Biden's reelection campaign has made Project 2025 a primary target, setting up a separate website dedicated to criticism of it and highlighting liberal media reaction.
Critics are calling it the fascist playbook, and it should be one of the reasons, if not the reason, that you vote this November.
The sweeping plan also calls for slashing government funding for renewable energy and climate change mitigation. The Department of Education would be eliminated. The Federal Bureau of Investigation would be overhauled top to bottom, as would the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees the Voice of America. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
NATO allies on Wednesday pledged to support Ukraine on an irreversible path to integration, while calling on China to cease all support for Russia's war efforts against Kyiv. This as new fighter jets are set to patrol the skies of Ukraine. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has the details.
American-made F-16 fighter jets now heading to Ukraine from NATO allies Denmark and the Netherlands. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
The transfer of F-16s is officially underway, and Ukraine will be flying F-16s this summer.
All 32 allies in a communique calling Ukraine's path to NATO membership, quote, irreversible, in a strong message to Russian President Vladimir Putin that he simply cannot wait out NATO allies. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
The work we are doing together now will ensure that when the time is right, Ukraine can join without delay. It is not a question of if, but when.
U.S. President Joe Biden pressed NATO allies to continue their increased defense spending in order to keep up with Russia's wartime production levels.
They're significantly ramping up their production of weapons, munitions, and vehicles. And they're doing it with the help of China, North Korea, and Iran. We cannot, in my view, we cannot allow the alliance to fall behind.
The alliance also calling on China to cease its support of Russia's war machine, saying it cannot enable the largest war in Europe in nearly 80 years without negatively impacting its interest and reputation. Again, NATO Stoltenberg.
The declaration we have agreed today is the strongest message NATO allies have ever sent China's contributions to Russia's illegal war against Ukraine.
Analyst and veteran Brad Bowman.
They're providing dual-use technology and support to Russia's defense industrial base, enabling Putin's war of aggression in Ukraine and allowing him to fight longer and to replace his losses.
Analyst and veteran Brad Bowman tells VOA that calling out China was long overdue for the 32-member bloc.
Europeans are dying in Europe in a war of aggression from the Kremlin with the support of Iran, North Korea, and China, period.
Non-NATO partners from the Indo-Pacific joined NATO allies for the summit in Washington this week. Officials say attendance by Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand sends a message to China that democratic alliances will stand up for the rule of law, no matter where an aggressor tries to break it. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan's state-owned television says President Salva Kiir has sacked his finance minister, who was just 4 months into the job. Reuters says it's the sixth replacement in the post since 2020. Kiir gave no reason for firing Awo Daniel Chuang, who was appointed in mid-March. Economist Marial Deng has been tapped to replace him as finance minister. South Sudan's economy has been under pressure in recent years amid communal violence, with crude oil export revenue dwindling since a civil war in 2013 and 2018, and more recently, export disruptions due to conflicts in neighboring Sudan. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of